Hello, I'm Don Russo. This is the second session in our series on healthcare in America. And today's topic is what drives American healthcare. We're posing the question, does fear, power, and money drive American healthcare? And those are certainly strong factors. We want to look at what those factors mean when people have an experience with a physician or a hospital, an illness or an injury. And we want to look at maybe some other factors that arise when people work in healthcare or when patients come into it. I wanted to start with just a few of the values. We looked at some yesterday. What we say are some of the established values in American healthcare that would be articulated in hospitals from East Coast to West Coast. Any physicians, any nurses working in healthcare would say, yes, these are the values of healthcare. This is what we're trying to do. We'd say that they were restoration of health is the fundamental value of healthcare. Restoration of health. Oftentimes, people don't come into any contact with healthcare system until something goes wrong. So the fix-it approach is a very, very big value. What drives people in their work. Relief of symptoms. Chronic backache. Pushes people into contact with those who maybe have some way of relieving pain. Relief of symptoms. Restoration of function. An accident, a broken leg, now how am I going to walk? There's tremendous resources devoted to restoration of function. Yesterday, for several days here this week, I happened to visit with a guy who joined us at meals named Daryl. You met Daryl, who's on the staff here, repairing things. 67 years old. 21 years ago, he had a heart valve transplant, heart valve surgery. 21 years. Where he would have died, but because of this substitute piece of fabric, Teflon-coated fabric developed by two surgeons in Portland, 21 more years. And he says he's healthier now than he was 21 years ago. He can do more push-ups. 60 push-ups every morning, he says. Whoa. So, restoration of function. His heart works because of intervention from the healthcare system. The saving or prolonging of life. Oh, there's Daryl again. Education and counseling of patients, avoiding harm in patient care. So these are values that all of us would say, you know, this is why we work in healthcare. This is why people come into healthcare. This is what people expect or people need. This is why we exist, why our healthcare system exists. And yesterday we went over all of those values through history, that reason dominates healthcare today. Knowledge makes one elite. Arete, excellence. The standards in healthcare are very high. And those who enter healthcare to work in those fields have to come up to the standards. And those who come in needing something have very high expectations. Anything less than that, people are easily dissatisfied and they take action when they're dissatisfied. There are some fundamental principles in healthcare. Respect is one. Respect for persons. Respect for life, the sanctity of life, a respect, an awesome high regard for patients and life. Beneficence, justice, and non-maleficence. We went over that a little bit yesterday. Hippocrates, remember the Greek father of medicine, in the Hippocratic Oath, one of the very strong statements made by Hippocrates is, first of all, do no harm. And we call that today non-maleficence. So that, you know, caution, don't make things worse when someone's hurting. But the second one is really a more positive look at that, and called beneficence. Do good. Do good. Beneficence. Bene. Do good. Use medicine to do good. It's a fundamental value that everyone would agree with. Sometimes we don't think we learn these things in school formally, but they become ingrained in us, and there's something about us in the beginning maybe that even drives us into that work. Justice. Justice deals with how do we use the limited resources for the greatest good of all. And that's kind of a hot topic today. Some feel we're not very just in the allocation of healthcare resources. Some have more, others have less, unfairly. But justice is a fundamental value in healthcare. And so it's what I'm trying to bring forth here, these fundamental values sometimes seem to be pushed aside or not there at all. But what I'm saying is that these are the fundamentals, these are the foundations. And sometimes people become distracted from the fundamentals, and then we have trouble. So fear, power, and money. Let's look at what happens with fear, power, and money. If you think of your own experience, think of an experience that you had personally with healthcare. When something happened that you couldn't fix yourself, you picture an experience in your life, something happened and you couldn't handle it yourself. What comes to mind?
Thyroid tumor.
Ah, thyroid tumor. What happens when you hear the word tumor?
Red flags go up.
Red flags. Fear.
You think, yeah, fear.
Alarm. Everything starts cooking inside, right? It's a heightened sense of emotion when someone in a hospital says tumor, right? Tumor, yeah. What others come to mind? Are there examples you had? Anybody want to? When did you have an experience, an intimate experience that took you into healthcare?
Birth
of a child? Something more than you could handle yourself?
Colon cancer.
Colon cancer, oh. There's one that triggers fear, huh? Okay, so fear is a dominant human emotion when we enter healthcare. When we seek healthcare, it's most often driven by fear. Something happens that we are not capable of handling on our own. It's beyond our means. This is how American healthcare developed. It was in rural America 100 years ago. You were talking about, you know, we changed things with schooling. The source of healthcare was oftentimes in the home, and the woman was the provider. And her means of providing were based on what her mother taught her, maybe, or things that she learned. But we grew beyond that, and grew. So now the woman in the house is certainly still in the home. The woman is the decision maker. Surveys across America, we ask, who makes the decisions about when to go to the hospital, when to go to the doctor? The woman makes those decisions. The woman is the decision maker. So she makes the decision, we need to go see the doctor. Maybe you resisted for a while, huh?
Not at all.
No, you didn't. No.
They found it purely by accident.
Oh.
Had a chest cough. Unrelated. Physical showed an anemic situation. And they suggested a colonoscopy to determine if it was just a bleeding polyp. Mm-hmm. And came out of that with the notice that it was a fist-sized tumor.
Mm.
That led the next 24 hours to clear my desk, determine what surgeon I was going to use, what anesthesiologist I was going to use, probably equally important as the surgeon, and what hospital, and it led me to selecting what bed in the hospital.
What bed?
Mm-hmm. I was going to be there for 10 days. I wanted a view.
You had a choice?
Oh yeah, you have a choice.
Now here's some rational reasoning and going on in your process, you know, clearing desk and choosing a surgeon. And that's very, very, very strong. Like we said yesterday, reason dominates medicine.
I want that thing out as quickly as possible.
But the emotional side is there too, sometimes covered up, sometimes very, very, very red and flaming. And so it's that fear that triggers a response on the other side. What happens when someone's afraid and someone else has the means to solve your fear, what goes on with that other, on that other side? What new?
That's the power.
That's
side.
The power. That's the power. Yeah. Fear drives need. You know, we need, and when you have what someone needs,
you have power.
You have power. And so the power in healthcare, in medicine, is the knowledge of how to fix that problem. You know, largely that reasoning, that science, that technology. And so here's what happens daily, every day in healthcare. Fear, need, power. And those who have the power also bring in the money. And so we have this play every day, fear, power, and money. And left just to their own forces, those play themselves out in ways that in most cases, day after day, the fear is resolved, the problem is corrected, and there's an exchange of money. Now that's American healthcare. Now maybe in Europe, the money part or the power part isn't maybe as strong as in America, but we're this week looking at American healthcare. Unique American, this is the American way. So, I don't know, fear, power, money have these attributes, these negative sense, you get this negative sense that, you know, they're playing on my fear and they're robbing me of my money. And then on the other side, people are saying, well, how much is it worth for Daryl to have 21 more years of life because someone had the ability to, you know, do something there? How much is that worth? You know, how much is that worth to have that cancer cut out and thrown away?
Should that treatment be dependent only if I have the ability to pay?
Yeah, is it worth more to you than it is to him?
Should our society be able to withhold that treatment to me if I did not have the ability, but they still had the ability to solve the problem? Mm-hmm. A real strong moral issue.
Moral issue.
Yeah. And there's the other strange thing that goes on there, which is the rational side, when it comes to the money transaction, often disappears. If you were going to go out and buy a car or buy a house or contract for somebody to redo your lawn, you make this rational decision, it's going to cost me this much money and I do it. And when they say, you better get that tumor out in 24 hours, then the money side of it, the rational side of it, of looking at the dollars from the patient's point of view, often kind of evaporates. Guy says, I want the best surgeon. I want all the tests. I want everything to happen because this has got to come out right. Yeah. So the normal personal controls that we exercise over cost frequently aren't there. I was in the hospital a year and a half ago with a viral sepsis, and I was really, really,
sepsis. Uh-oh.
Really, really sick. And the last thing in my mind was, what was this going to cost? They were all saying, man, you're in bad shape. We can put you in here and do this stuff. And I knew I was really sick. So I would not have said, I can save this much money here if I go for a different, I like my doctor, but if I take this other doctor, if I go with this other hospital, I'll say, I just say, do whatever it takes.
And there again is where your insurance carrier or your HMO or whatever system that you're using to provide this health care has done the shopping and the bargaining and the negotiating for how much this care is going to cost you and virtually them. And they have done it a year and a half, 2 years before you ever went to the hospital.
Good point. As long as I had insurance.
As long as you had insurance.
Yeah, I agree. That's the extremely valuable function of the insurance system, which we all jump on saying, hey, this is a middleman grabbing off all of this money. I do think that's a factor too. But if we didn't have that, we'd be in real trouble. My wife had outpatient surgery about 3 years ago, and we got the bill from the hospital, $2,100, and it said, we've sent this in to your insurance company. So about 3 weeks later, we get the paperwork from the insurance company that says, we have a preferred provider arrangement with this hospital, and so they're discounting it by $700, and it's now $1,400, and you have to pay your 20%. And had the insurance company not been, in fact, I called up the hospital, this is what started me on my crusade. I called up the hospital and I said, if I weren't insured, how much would I have to pay you?
The full amount.
The full amount, you know, right off the full amount. So I said, but I'm the person who could least afford it. It bothered me because I only had to pay 20% of a smaller number. And they said, well, yeah, that's true, but that's how it works. And I said, if you're totally destitute, you know, we can talk, but other than that, no. But the insurance company was the big, the point I was making was the insurance company, it was really our, was serving that function of bringing in the rational look at the cost ahead of time, in effect ahead of time. It was all prepared. When she went in there, somebody was watching out for that side of it.
Statistically, they know how many people are going to be in the hospital with colon cancer, and statistically they know how much you're going to be spending, given the right number of people and the ages and the sexes. They can make very close determinations as far as an accurate projection of need, and with that need, a projection of what the cost is going to be. And then they can tell you ahead of time what your premium will be to cover that.
Well, this this vehicle of insurance has an interesting history to it. And you may be aware, you know, that right now it's kind of considered a fundamental thing that goes with employment that you look for. It's pretty important. But the essence of insurance is a four-letter word, risk. It's the shifting of risk, so that an individual who says, I am at risk if something happens, I'm responsible, I am liable for my own expense or my own loss or whatever it might be. I could take that risk and carry that risk myself and save up enough money so that someday should something happen, I'll just cover that, I'll take care of that, I'll be able to make it. But people started thinking, well, what if we share that risk? What if we all put in a little bit as we go and shift that risk off of my shoulders onto this group, this plan, this company, let them take the risk, and I'll minimize mine by paying $10 a month, and if the bill's $100, I don't have to pay $100, the plan will pay it. So that's what insurance does. It takes away risk, or minimizes, it transfers risk, financial risk.
But there has been a major shift very recently. If you go back 20 years ago, the function of the insurance operation was to determine what that risk was and calculate the dollars that everyone had to pay in. And then simply was a transfer agent of money to the healthcare provider. Now we have this very different function, which, what's your name?
Paul.
Paul brought up where it no longer works that way. In the old days, the hospital or the doctor or the lab could charge whatever they wanted. The insurance company simply paid it for the most part. And now we've entered this era fairly recently where the insurance companies and the large employers are in effect setting what you can charge.
To a degree, but going back 20, 30, 40 years ago, the original Blue Cross Blue Shield programs were not driven by the consumer, they were driven by the provider. The doctors
right.
formed these groups to be able to be prepaid for their services. they were, you know, tired of getting chickens. Now, you can only get so many chickens, and, you know, your chicken coop gets full. You want something else. So let's form this blue shield, and we will, let's see, there's an orthopedic guy, there's a gynecologist, et cetera, and we'll form this group, and we'll agree that our services will be provided for anyone who subscribes to our program, and then we will jointly share the benefits of this pool of money that is coming in. And they actually own the companies. But that has evolved out of that to a degree that the doctors no longer specifically own it as an individual, but the Blue Shields and Blue Crosses have become huge providers of medical services and become, rather than an association of doctors wanting something besides chickens, they become big insurance companies.
Yeah, the early 60s is when employers began to offer insurance coverage to employees as a benefit, and employers were grateful to do that. It was something new, that they were, it was a luxury that, you know.
It was cheap.
It was a positive thing.
$20 a month.
The thing that changed was the cost of health care kept going up so fast that the insurance companies were passing on these increases to their subscribers, and people were complaining. So in response to people's complaints about the money, those same insurers developed a concept they called managed care, which meant managing the healthcare experience from the perspective of those who pay the bill, not so much from the physician's determination of whether this was cancer or not, but from the perspective of paying the cost of it. We're going to manage the care. And so it started becoming a very competitive, business-oriented approach to this benefit of health insurance. And now the plan where you have, you know, your wife gets a preferred provider discount because a group has come in and said, here are 2,000 families or 8,000 lives or whatever, we will guarantee that all of them will come to you, you hospital, you doctor, in return for accepting lower payment for your charges.
There's a little different angle on how money drives things. Our son took his medical residency at Hennepin General in Minneapolis, which is right in the center of the city, deals with largely very low income or even homeless indigent people. And he finished that just a little over a year ago, and to his mind, he finished just in time, because the way things were changing in the Medicare field, the doctors that he had had contact with, who were completely committed to give these new doctors the best training that they could get, can no longer do that because of the, and don't ask me how this, all these mechanics work, but because they're dealing largely with low income or no income people, and the system is not providing as much money for those people. A lot of the doctors that he had the most respect for felt they had no choice but to leave, or to just get so many more patients in order to get the hospital's income up, that he was afraid, and the medical staff was afraid that the training for physicians was going to decrease, you know, was going to get to a much poorer level than it had been.
Yeah, those are constant threats today on hospitals all across America. And it's something the hospitals want, you know, a hospital wants its community to trust in it. The hospitals want people to have confidence that when something goes wrong, the hospital's there for them. You know, and that's driven by the same Christian principles for most hospital people, as what we read in Jeremiah this morning. And, you know, trust in the Lord, you know, to heal. It's that way. That's our fundamental stuff. But today's pressures are saying, no, you can't do that anymore.
Yeah, it's got to be the dollar. The line is the dollar.
Now that's the battle. The good against the evil that's played out every day in healthcare and many other sectors of life.
There's constant change in the providing of healthcare. Hospitals are going under a couple of current changes. One of them being that the hospitals, in order to become more financially solvent, are buying doctors' practices and bringing the doctors in as staff into the hospital, keeping the practice out there in the city or suburbia. The patients believe that the doctor is still in private practice, but in reality the doctor is now working for the hospital. The change comes when you see the bill. The bill comes from the hospital, not from the doctor. The change comes in his referral. All of his referrals go to that hospital. All of his referrals to the other specialties that he needs to refer you to go to doctors that are associated with the hospital. Instead of sending you to Smith Klein Lab, they all of a sudden refer you to the hospital lab. And containing the patient within that system, it's a big business. There's no business in America, I don't believe, that generates the kind of monies that healthcare does.
It's huge. 15% of the gross national product of America.
The largest employer in the world was the Russian army. They were the largest employer. Well, with the disbanding of the Russian army, now the largest employer in the world is the English healthcare. One out of six Englishmen work for the healthcare system in England.
What is it here?
I don't know.
You know?
Not nearly that.
Well, it's one out of eight, roughly, are involved in healthcare.
One out of eight people?
You say, well, that's just a, you know, transfer. If it's 15% of the gross national product is healthcare, it's about one out of eight people, roughly.
Well, if
some form. That's why I'm not just using the term medicine. The practice of medicine is what physicians do who are licensed and have MD after their name. But so many others are connected. It's broader than medicine now. Healthcare, 15% of gross national product, one out of eight, roughly.
Healthcare is the people that manufacture toothbrushes. It is.
It is, that's true.
I mean, it's one of the preventive things that you have in dentistry. Healthcare is a nutritionist that works for snappy foods that determines how to make their product more balanced so that people don't get sick when they eat it.
But your son is feeling this kind of the pressure is so severe that things can't go on the way they used to.
Right.
In the good old days, and now we're going to leave. We're going to have to quit because we can't do what really needs to be done.
Right.
That's a strong sentiment, and that's pushing against these fundamental values that say, well, wait a minute, what are we doing this for in the first place? Is it fear, power, and money, or is it human compassion? And that's where the decisions that lay in front of people every day are being made. And there's a great contrast, and sometimes we don't even think of it that way, but there's a great contrast between what it could be and what is in these daily decisions, depending on where people are coming from when they come from their heart or they come from their wallet.
My brother spent quite a few years in nursing home development for a small business and also for a very large one, where he was the guy who went out and found the new areas to build the nursing homes and got the certificates of need and all of that stuff, and then oversaw some of the construction. And his opinion was that in that field, that on average you could see a difference in the quality of care between outfits, nursing homes that had a religious or spiritual mission to care for people. An example of that was a place where he built a big addition for a nursing home. It was run by some Franciscan order. And that contrasted with nursing homes where the primary goal, the reason it was built, was to make money for an owner or investors or whatnot. And I'm interested in whether you think that's a valid notion and whether that applies also to hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the big question. That's the battle every day. And let's look at it in terms of these three words again. That's an excellent example. Is it to make money, or is it they're driven by the mission of Christian values? So let's look at these three words. And see, where do we get fear? Where does power come from? And what's money all about? Just look at what is fear? Where does it come from? What's fear? We all know it because we feel it, but what do we mean by fear? And I'd suggest there's two ways to look at each of these terms.
The fear of the unknown.
Fear of the unknown. Fear. And what's that unknown going to do?
Well, the unknown is you don't know if you need the medical care.
You might die.
You might die. You might get hurt. You might suffer. You might lose.
Fear of the consequence.
The consequence, yeah.
Yeah. Losing something.
Losing, hurting. Fear.
Losing and hurting, yeah.
Okay, now, is there another way to look at fear in a Christian sense? What is, if you look in the book of Proverbs, I think one of the first Proverbs in there is about speaks to fear. Where does fear connect spiritually that it's not negative? Where is the beginning of wisdom in the book of Proverbs? You know that one? Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Yeah, fear of the Lord. So if we say fear of losing, fear of hurting, fear of damage, fear of the unknown, fear of the consequences, fear of loss on one side, and look at the other and say, fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Now what is fear? It's a priority of how we see our life. You know, so if we say, fear of the Lord motivates me to act in a certain way. You know, Jeremiah was warning us, you know, change your lives. Fear the Lord, I'm not going to do it that way because the big guy's watching. The big one is watching. So let's, you know, say there's two ways to look at it. Now, power. What is power? There's two ways to look at power. What is the negative? What is the way that disturbs us about power?
Can destroy us.
Someone else's power to destroy us, to hurt us. To
loss of control.
Loss of control. Excellent. Men tend to fear loss of control, maybe more than women, but loss of control, major thing there. Hmm. One of the ways is fear, or power, these are connections, but power.
Privilege.
Privilege, the elite. Mm-hmm. And if you have it, you like it. If you don't, you resent it.
Too bad.
Yeah. Well, if I can't have that kind of a watch or whatever, I'll steal it. I'll get it anyway.
Mm-hmm. When I had to go into the hospital for 10 days, I used my power to select the room I wanted. I gave them no choice. I said, I want a room with a view of the park, not a room with a view of the wall. And I went directly to the hospital administrator, and I had sat on the negotiation table with him, 6 months earlier. I knew him by his first name. And I said, do you want to show me the rooms or do you want your assistant to? I gave him his choice.
Yeah, you have power.
You have no power there. Good for you.
There was nothing said. I'll have my assistant show you. And very quickly, I chose which room I wanted. And that was power. Mm-hmm.
It's usually the other way around.
Yeah. What's gratifying about your story is that you are the client and you are getting what we consider to be your right to have that power, to have a power of choice. To be able to say, yes, I would like this. I mean, okay, if it's last minute and there's no room in the inn except by the wall, you're glad you get that room by the wall. If you can make a reservation that far in advance, you should have that power. We should all have that power.
That's right.
But we're paying the money to have that power.
But isn't that odd? If we go to a hotel, I routinely do that. Check out where the room is and get the one that's not next to the kitchen or or whatnot. But I bet practically no one does what you did. Say, hey, I should have a right. I'm stuck in here. I'm suffering anyway. I may as well be able to look out and see the view.
Right.
That
should be a right.
No, I'm a general.
Oh, you did. That's what made me just go ahead. A beautiful view.
We become a general has a view of the right part.
Patients have tremendous power when they come from the right way.
Place.
Well, they come from the money side.
Well, wait, let's turn this around. Now, where is the spiritual view of power? What is the source of power in spiritual?
I'm not Saint Joseph.
God is the source of power. God. The Holy Spirit.
The power of God. Power originates in God, we believe. Mm-hmm. And so if we say that power comes from God, then how can that power work through us? Whether we're providers or patients or paying the bills or cleaning the floors. I mean, there is a power, and it is in the foundations of healthcare. And when people realize it and act on it, good things happen.
Well, I think there's an intimidation that takes place with the average person.
I mean,
they come in, they're all uniformed, and they all know more about the technical stuff than you do, and they have all this machinery that you have no idea what it does or how it does it. It just looks like it's going to hurt at some point or another. And I mean, all of this is, and you're desperate because you wouldn't be there if you weren't. So, I mean, there's a way in which you're almost afraid to stand up for yourself because you have lost authority over yourself.
But knowledge gives you power. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Knowledge of what's going on gives you power. I left the hospital and went across the street to the oncology department. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that they were going to do is draw blood. I said, why? Well, we need to do a blood workup. I said, one was done at the hospital this morning. Get their report. Well, we need to do one over here. I said, no, you don't. Call over there and have them send it over.
You're making them be economical. Someone might lose their job.
Well, blood tests generate money. Mm-hmm. The oncology department is not tied with the hospital. So they need to generate those kinds of income also.
So there was an economic thing going on.
There was an economic reason that they wanted the blood test. Because they did it themselves.
Yeah, knowledge does give power.
Yeah.
And there's knowledge of the science and the business and knowledge of the heart and those things can work for everybody. They can work. But when we turn away from those and we turn to the other types of power, it just makes sense.
Yeah, you have to know.
Trouble.
Yeah,
there's
that's
what
right.
you fear when they're taking away my clothes, they're taking away
yeah.
my.
Yeah.
here I am helpless in their midst, it's yeah. their house, not mine.
Yeah.
And then they bring you the food that you didn't order.
Oh, yeah, right.
And you say, what is this? Do you know how much you're paying for that food? What do you charge patients in your hospital for their food on a daily basis? 120?
There isn't a direct charge.
A day?
Just part of
120 bucks?
Room yeah. charge.
Room charge.
Oh, my, well, it's not just for the meals.
But it's broken down. And it's broken down into department. And a good average rate is about $120 a day for dietary.
Per patient. Per person?
Per patient.
Please.
What? That's necessary.
What?
There's a separate room charge then?
No.
No, okay, then you're
we're dealing
it's
in
not just food, yeah. It's
$1,000 a day. It's $1,000 a day to be in the hotel with the bed and the nurse. That's average. Just to be in the bed, it's $1,000.
And out of that is an allocation for housekeeping. There's an allocation for capital expenditures. There's an allocation for dietary. And your dietary expense is a big one, and then they bring you strained pea string bean soup, and you say, "What is this?" Well, that's what we're serving today. Well, most people, oh, okay. But if you know that you can say no, I don't want that. Send the dietitian up and let me talk to her.
Well, that means we're just third. Let's look at money for a second.
Yeah, let's look at money.
All right, what is money? What do we mean by, how would you define, if you look it up, or a child or someone is asking, what is money? What is money?
It's a promissory note.
What is bargaining power?
It's a printed seashell.
Hmm. Yeah, you're kidding me. Those are all good. Yeah, you call it coinage, or it's a system of using something to represent value that can something that can be exchanged. It's for the purpose of exchange, and it works really well in many aspects of our life, right? And it's hard to live without it, but you know, if you look at what it is, it's a system of to exchange value. Now that's kind of a positive way. Now, if we look spiritually and we say, well, now what is the, you know, spiritually, what do we see, what's our lesson about money? There's a verse, and I got it written down here, but it comes to mind about money. What is it? Does it come to mind, anybody else? There's a note here.
Give unto Caesar's what is.
Caesar's?
Yeah, that gets to it too, but the love of money is the root of all evil.
Oh, yeah.
Where's the, I don't know the scriptural citation for that. So is it money itself?
The power that the money gives you.
The love of money is the root of all evil, is what the line says.
And how do you relate that with fill out the insurance forms before we look at you?
Yeah. The love of money, the passion, the want, the desire for personal gain, personal satisfaction. That's the negative side of money. But the positive side is that this is a way we exchange value. This is a system we use to exchange value. You know, a dollar bill is a dollar bill, and it'll get you something else in exchange. Now that gets pressured every day in healthcare and in many other parts of America too. But it's especially, this is the one most people get most upset about, is the cost of health. It just makes people mad. Does it make you?
Oh, yeah. Especially because it isn't even, there's no promise it's going to be effective. You know, you have to pay this much and you're still going to die of cancer. Great Scott, you know? Mm-hmm. It's almost like, oh.
Well, you take your car in and you have a valve job done on it. If it doesn't work, you bring it back and
they have to do it again.
Do it again free.
Yeah.
That's right.
But you go in and you have something done in the hospital by a physician and it doesn't work. And well, we tried that, so we'll have to do it over again because mm-hmm. it didn't work. No free.
And when they were trying to get universal health care passed, there was all this protest that we wouldn't have the high quality care that we have now. And I haven't experienced high quality care since I was taken care of by my uncle Ted in Cokato Hospital in the 1950s. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, there hasn't been quality care. So what are they talking about? Quality care. When I go to a clinic in Norway, I get better treatment under socialized medicine. They care about me. They have more of a mission. The Hippocratic Oath means more to them than it does to these hospitals that I've taken my children to in the United States. So what are they talking about?
Well, here's what they're talking about in terms of the business approach or the money approach to healthcare. That in today's America, here's the three major factors from the financial, administrative, the planning, policy perspective: cost of care, quality of care, and access to care. Who can get how much of what they need? And you know what they say about these three? Here's the three major factors. Pick any two. You can have two out of three, but you can't have
all three. Why not?
Well, because if you want high quality for everybody, what happens to cost?
Why?
Because of the systems that we have.
Yeah, exactly. There's no, if we had a different system, we could have all three.
And administrative people would say, doesn't work that way.
But that's because of the system, isn't it?
No, pick any system. If you wanted, let's say you wanted high quality and low cost. High quality and low cost. They say, you can do that, but you can't make everybody, you can't allow everybody to have the same resources.
Low aggregate cost for the whole country. Right.
Well, what if you had low cost and high quality for people who were of lower incomes, and then high cost and high quality for people who were of higher incomes?
And you have to go
That's
back.
That's what we have now.
You have to go back and relate it to
that isn't what we have
the schools. You have to go back and relate it to what I was talking about yesterday with the schools. 100 years ago, you had the same thing. The access was only for those that could afford it. The quality was fine for those that had the wherewithal to be able to get in. But for the most, for the highest percentage of American children did not get educated because we did not have free schools. We did not have public education. We did not have socialized education. We have socialized education today. You don't want to call it that, but that's what we have. All of the people contribute through their taxes, and all of the children benefit from it. Everyone contributes to education, whether you have children or not. When only the wealthy can have their children educated, they said something's wrong, so they changed the system. Today, as he said, you've got those three things. Even picking the two of them doesn't always necessarily work. You go into some of the HMOs, the health maintenance organizations, and they throw out two of them and give you only one.
Well, what about this whole thing of you get what you pay for? I mean, I think that's more pertinent to the American system. I mean, I don't think that there's high quality, as high quality care for poor people as there is for rich people in any way in this country. There never has been. And I mean, I don't know where.
There is and there isn't. At the hospital where I work, I was on the critical care unit one day, and a physician, an internal medicine physician, was making rounds. And he had just finished with two patients. And both had heart attacks. And he had come out to the nurse's station and was making some notes. And he just was struck by what he had just done. He says, you know, those two patients both had heart attacks. The man on the left, insurance, employed, all of that, family man doing his thing. The guy on the right fell off the train in Chilliquin this morning and got the ambulance and brought him to the hospital. He's getting the exact same care.
Well, that's good to know.
So in that way, America works so that when someone needs it, the resources are there in both hospitals and most times.
Emergency care, but not chronic.
But will they get the same follow-up? Will they get the same rehabilitation? Will they get the same drug maintenance?
No, their quality of life is totally different. Now, one person is coming back into a system that's passed more there, and the other one is
back on the train
and on the road. Nothing much going on.
The chances of him being able to walk into a pharmacy and saying, "Hey, I need some free medicine today."
So
it's a double standard. To Norway.
There's this high contradiction between, we all get the same in one sense, and yet no, we don't.
Well, the example that I'm more familiar with is childbirth and prenatal care and so on, in that we have such a high proportionate, in the Western world, we have the highest loss of children and babies, infants. And it's a puzzle. Why? Why are we so high?
Because there's so many that don't have access to good health care. They can't afford it.
It's both the individual and the system.
Some even that can afford it. I was scratching my head trying to figure out a method by which I could ensure that the people that were in our program that became pregnant would go in for an exam during their first trimester.
Mm-hmm.
It cost them $5. $5 copayment to go in for an exam.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even have, they could go to any OBGYN that they wanted to. And yet a high number of them waited until the second trimester for their first exam. And these were educated people. You figure that out. Finally came up with the idea of giving them a free baby seat for their car if they go in earlier. I couldn't sell that program.
Well, we're near the end of this hour, and what we're trying to look at today in this session is fear, power, and money. What are these factors? Where do they come from? What does it do to us? What do these factors do to us when illness or injury strike? And what does our system do with these forces? Do these forces drive American healthcare? Fear, power, and money. Are these the major forces?
And are there any checks to this? That's the other thing that I'm curious to know about. Your comments are helpful to know that we have some personal power that we can take. But what about other ways?
Well, that's what I'm suggesting here, is that there are checks and that there's this continual battle. Remember how we defined healthcare yesterday as the struggle to do good in the face of the inherent imperfections of humanity. We have our weaknesses, and we feel we hang by a thread at times when that hospital experience happens, that severe illness or injury. And so the struggle to do good, that's what's really driving healthcare.
But what
I'm suggesting. You don't buy that?
No, I don't, because there's such a striking difference between Deaconess Hospital in Minneapolis, which is now closed, and Fairview Hospital. Both of them are Lutheran hospitals. And Deaconess Hospital, the nurses say to the patients, that's how, to me anyway, I mean, they were a thousand light years away from the nurses at Fairview that you can't even get to come to
room. That's it. There's the
room.
There's
well,
the
what's
struggle.
The cultural issue here? Why
it's
is
the
there
struggle.
Such a huge difference? And why is the best gone and the worst even more common?
Well, it's the playing out of humanity.
But you know, this is the...
That's how life is.
You mean there's no way to stop it? We have to sort of accept it?
No, we have to look for what is the fair power of money we can use in towards good, towards doing good, against the struggle of the forces to do evil. That's what's happening in our lives in other ways, is it not? How come our communities have crime?
If it had been brought forward in a little bit different venue with a different person leading healthcare reform, I believe the Democrats this last election, 4 years ago, mm-hmm. would have, they were on record of saying, we want to change healthcare. We want to do some things. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Hillary found out the hard way that she was dealing with professional politicians who disliked the president's wife coming in and telling him what to do. And they said, mm-hmm. put in your ear, lady. Mm-hmm. And they killed health care reform. Mm-hmm. And that's my opinion, for whatever it's worth in a nutshell.
Well, that really hits on what I wanted to close with today. One of the guys who was credited with starting the managed care concept in America is a professor at Stanford named Enthoven, Alain Enthoven. I don't know if you know that name, but he was quoted in Modern Healthcare magazine just last week. But they asked him, how come this thing isn't going the way he thought it would go? And he said, well, it's the insensitivities that get us in trouble. And that's my point, is that these things happen, these forces play out against each other. It's the insensitivities that get us in trouble, and it is the sensitivities that get us out of it. And isn't that not in the spirit of Holden and in a Christian way, isn't that how things are? And if we look at what drives healthcare, is that it's a daily individual matter. Take it broadly. Your own health, your family's health, your loved one's health, the health of strangers that you encounter for some reason. And what drives healthcare? Is it fear, power, and money, which could be moment to moment, or is it something else? And William Blake, a poet, says it's mercy, pity, peace, and love that drive healthcare. I'd suggest that fear, power, and money are one way to look at it. On the other side is mercy, pity, peace, and love.
The left side is winning.
Yeah. It seems.
And
it
how
seems,
we, but I
those
still
are the headlines,
want it.
But that's not the day-to-day. The day-to-day stuff is your case. It's your case. It's your case. It's your. You've had these experiences.
And when you have it, you don't negotiate. You don't say, well, instead of doing it for $1,000 a day, will you take me for $500 a day? And when they figure, well, gee, they didn't object to $1,000, they probably won't object to $1,500.
If Jeremiah was the voice of hope, then put it into healthcare. And say, we need to hope that what we have driving healthcare is this, the mercy, pity, peace, and love, not fear, power, and money.
But the other side is, beyond hoping, somehow, people of goodwill need to organize so that politically we can make it work better and be available for more people.
Yeah.
We've been unsuccessful with that, and I agree with the Hillary Clinton analysis is probably true.
But that isn't the only reason.
No, it's not the only reason, but as a society, the people who really need help are sort of off our screen, and we're not organized to change things around very much.
Oh, but there's huge, huge efforts going on every day for that. It's a battle. And that's tomorrow, is the hospital is complex, maybe the most complex of any American institution. What makes a hospital complex? That's what we'll look at tomorrow. Things that most of us don't realize. And that those in hospitals really don't want us to know about. It's just, on the outside, hospitals want people to be confident in that. On the inside, it's a daily battle. The politics in the hospital are extreme, any hospital. You gave an example of your son's experience in training. It's daily there's a daily battle going on in there between these two sides. And those efforts are happening.
I think those are internal once you're within the system, once you're being cared for, interacting with the system. But I still say we are ignoring the people who can't get access to begin. It doesn't matter about the quality or the cost, they're just out of the system.
I'll pose a question to you. You live in Washington?
In Ohio.
It's too bad.
It is too bad.
It's too bad because you don't know the internal politics we have. You live in Washington.
Yeah.
5 years ago, Washington's legislature and governor signed a very broad health care reform package. It's going to be the pilot for the whole United States. And it went flying like the proverbial lead balloon. And even though it was passed into law, it died.
How did that work? There was no money behind it?
Too long of a story. Yes, there was no money behind it. They tried to broaden it too much. Mm. The death blow came when they added the migrant farm workers. Mm. Migrant farm workers were added. And they said, wait a minute, who's going to pay for them? When the actuaries were finished with the bill, it was not only going to take all of the money that the state was taking in, it was going to take 140% of the money, all of the money that the state had for current taxes to pay for it.
So the decision was, there's a class of people we're not going to take care of?
No. The decision was, we can't do it.
At all. They didn't do it at all.
Right, but that was the effect. Other people...
Oregon has their priority list. Do you still have that?
Mm-hmm.
And we will pay for all of these until we get to this point, and everything past here we can't pay for, so we won't do. So if you are in the top list, you quickly go to Oregon and you have it taken care of. And if you're in the bottom list, you were going to come to Washington to have it taken care of.
Minnesota has the same. There's like, they'll give you dental checkups, but no bridge work.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the stuff that really costs a lot of money, you're out to lunch.
You know, you were talking about quality of health care. I look at healthcare and I look at quality and I'm very attuned to it. And my wife got sick in Ashland, Oregon in the middle of the night and she had to go into the little tiny hospital that Ashland has. And she went in to the critical care unit there and was there for 3 days. And you know, that little tiny town had much better care than she would have received at Tacoma General or at St. Joe's Hospital, huge mega hospitals in the middle of a metropolitan city.
Sure.
And here's this little tiny town, and she had much, much better care.
I believe that.
There.
I know that's probably the small.
Not only the personal, but the medical care.
Better, yeah.
The techniques, the fact that they were working with her the moment she got to the door.
Mm-hmm. And it's personalized, more personalized. You feel
there was a MD that was on duty that night who sat with her for 11 hours. She was having problems with her heart and trying to get the beat regulated. And he sat there with her for 11 hours.
Yeah.
Good example. Let's close on that.
That's the mercy part.
Yeah, the mercy. That's the sensitivity. When the sensitivity is there, there's a good outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And when the sensitivity is missing, when something else, fear, power, and money, is too strong, then people are not satisfied.
But my kid got sick on the way to Holden last time in 87, and we had to go to the emergency in Spokane. It was a big hospital. And I was amazed at how good they were to us. We were not from the area. We had a health card, but how did they know? It wasn't the same insurance company or anything. And it was my husband, not me, who had it, my ex. But they were great, and my ex took forever to pay him. I mean, they had to carry that cost a long time because he was a jerk about paying his bills. So, I mean, there are large hospitals that are exceptions as well, but why do they have to prove the rule that by and large we don't get it?
Like I said yesterday, I have a high regard for America's healthcare system. It's a wonderful thing. There's tremendous resources and abilities there, and a lot of people with very good hearts. And yet, the headlines are the negatives, and those are certainly strong and they're very inflammatory. But our foundations and what drives us and what can drive people is a lot of good stuff, and I think that's where we're better served.